Hey there. If you stumbled on this by accident, or maybe you're just taking a chance, it's good news. You've entered the far middle. And that's a place where logic and rational thought, civil discourse, those things, they reign supreme. I'm your host, Nick DeOlias, and you can find all, 185 prior episodes. They're available to you on Apple and Spotify and Amazon, all those platforms, as well as on my website. I do have a website, nickdeolias.com. I encourage you to peruse it for other content beyond the Far Middle Archives, which you'll also find on the website. And as is our tradition in this space, we're going to start each episode with a sports dedication. And our sports dedication this week ties to the day after our air premiere date. So the day after would be December 12th, back in 1968. Something momentous happened in the world of tennis on that date. But more importantly, I think something momentous occurred in society. That's when Arthur Ashe became the first black men's player to be ranked number one in pro tennis, at the time by the USLTPA. And it was a busy time of firsts for him, because Ashe earlier became the first African-American man to win a major tennis title when he won the 1968 U.S. Open. He won three major single titles in his career. But this man, a Richmond native, has a story, of course, that goes beyond tennis. He came up in the era of segregation, and the Ashes lived in the caretaker's cottage in the grounds or on the grounds of Richmond's largest black-only public playground, which had four tennis courts. And that was fortuitous timing, because Ashe started playing tennis at 7 years of age. He got noticed by a man by the name of Ron Charity, who was a noted black tennis player in Richmond, and Charity taught Ashe the basics of the game. Ashe was awarded a tennis scholarship to UCLA, which was a tennis power, in 1963, and he won the NCAA singles title there and helped UCLA win a team national championship. He was in ROTC to help pay for college, and after graduating with a degree in business, Ashe joined the United States Army. He was assigned to the Military Academy at West Point, where he worked as a data processor and where he headed the Academy's tennis program. Not a bad person to head up that effort. He was honorably discharged in early 1969. Now, Ashe was a great communicator. He wrote for Time Magazine, The Washington Post, and was a TV commentator. He published a three-volume book that was titled A Hard Road to Glory, A History of the African-American Athlete, after he worked with a team of researchers for nearly 6 years on it. Ashe stated that the book was more important than any tennis title that he had won. Now, Arthur Ashe is believed to have acquired HIV from a blood transfusion he received during heart bypass surgery in the early 1980s, around 1983. And believe it or not, he suffered a heart attack at age 36. And his parents, unfortunately, suffered from similar heart troubles at young ages. And he publicly announced his AIDS illness in 1992, began working to educate others about the disease, which back in that time, a lot was not known or misunderstood. He founded the Arthur Ashe Foundation for the Defeat of AIDS and the Arthur Ashe Institute for Urban Health before he died at a too young age of 49 years in 1993. And he also spent much of the last years of his life writing his memoir, Days of Grace, finishing it less than a week before his death. Now, shortly after his death, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That was by President Clinton. Arthur Ashe Stadium, that's the main court for the U.S. Open, of course. It's the largest tennis arena in the world. That's, of course, named in his honor. Yeah, human beings, they don't come much better than Arthur Ashe, constant listeners, and a well-lived life that we dedicate episode 186 to. Now, we're famous for our connections on the far middle, so let's make our first connection from the writings and speeches of one great, Arthur Ashe, to another great who preceded him, and perhaps America's ultimate master of words, H.L. Mencken. Brilliant, outspoken, controversial for sure. And he was an admirer of Joseph Conrad, who we also admired a few episodes back on the far middle. And Mencken identified Ayn Rand as a young, promising author and thinker. And he publicly ridiculed William Jennings Bryan, who we dedicated an entire episode to and who I wrote about on nickdeolias.com. And he did it over Bryan's attack on evolution theory during the Scopes trial. So H.L. Mencken has many, I'll call it inter-episode connections within the far middle history. And Mencken was quite the critic of representative government. I think I found one of his quotes that summed up his view on that topic beautifully. He said, "The government consists of a gang of men exactly like you and me. They have, taking one with another, no special talent for the business of government. They have only a talent for getting and holding office. Their principal device to that end is to search out groups who pant and pine for something they can't get and to promise to give it to them. 9 times out of 10, that promise is worth nothing. The 10th time is made good by looting A to satisfy B." In other words, government is a broker in pillage, and every election is sort of an advance auction sale of stolen goods. Wow, I wonder what Mencken would think of the United States today. Boy, oh boy. Heck, while we're on the topic of good and bad forms of government and the pros and cons of each flavor or variation of government, let's make a connection to the next dot, a quote from fellow libertarian like myself and Pittsburgh native like myself, Dr. Ron Paul, who grew up a few miles down the road from where I live and where I grew up. Now, here was his view on how things could or should be. He said, "If we stuck to the Constitution as written, we would have no federal meddling in our schools, no Federal Reserve, no U.S. membership in the UN, no gun control, and no foreign aid. We would have no welfare for big corporations or the poor," he had poor in quotes, "no American troops in 100 foreign countries, no NAFTA, GATT, or Fast Track, no arrogant federal judges usurping states' rights, no attacks on private property, no income tax. We could get rid of most of the agencies and most of the budget. The government would be small, frugal, and limited." Right on, Dr. Paul, right on. Now, when government is small and frugal, as defined by Dr. Paul, and when the private sector is left to do its thing, and when representative government's downsides, highlighted by Mencken, those downsides are minimized, good things happen. One key place where you will see good things happening is in capital markets, which leads to our next connection, to a portion of a speech given by one of the true Wall Street legends of the modern age, Mr. Peter Lynch of Fidelity fame, the driver of one of the most iconic and successful mutual funds ever, the Magellan Fund, and a best-selling author and someone who coined the investing phrase, "invest in what you know." If you've ever heard that before, that came from Peter Lynch. I've always been a fan of his and an avid reader of his books and articles. He gave a speech in the early 1990s that I thought was a great summation of the power of investing over a long time horizon and how history and stats should inform an investor what to expect over that time. In short, you get downs and ups, not just ups, and it might be good food for thought considering where we are in today's markets. So here is Peter Lynch in 1994 in his speech that was, I believe, at the National Press Club. He said, "You should study history, and history is the important thing you learn from. What you learn from history is that the market goes down, it goes down a lot. The math is simple. There's been 93 years this century. This is easy to do. The market has had 50 declines of 10% or more. So 50 declines in 93 years, about once every 2 years, the market falls 10%. We call that a correction. That means, that's a euphemism for, losing a lot of money rapidly. We call it a correction. So 50 declines in 93 years, about once every 2 years, the market falls 10%. Of those 50 declines, 15 have been 25% or more. That's known as a bear market. We've had 15 declines of at least 25% in 93 years. So every 6 years, the market has a 25% decline. That's all you need to know. You need to know the market is going to go down sometimes. If you're not already for that, you shouldn't own stocks. And it's good when it happens, a market decline. If you like a stock at $14 and it goes to $6, that's great. You understand the company. You look at the balance sheet. They're doing fine. You are hoping to get to $22 with it. $14 to $22 is terrific. $6 to $22 is exceptional. So you take advantage of these declines. There are declines that are going to happen, and no one knows when they're going to happen. Yeah, that's from Peter Lynch. Free and invaluable advice from an expert in the field of investing, constant listeners. All right, Peter Lynch just advised us to invest in what we know. That sage view should also be applied to where and how we get our news. Is it maybe a variation being, know where your news is coming from? I have for you next a situation with a mainstream media outlet and a big issue in the news these days that should give you some pause as to the state of journalism. First, there is an outfit that is known as World Weather Attribution. It was founded, I don't know, about 10 years ago, and its mission is to create, manufacture, research linking extreme weather to climate change so that, you know, every storm, above average rain event, below average dry spell, blizzard, unusually cold or warm winter, etc., they're all potentially a sign or symptom of catastrophic climate change. And to make the claims under the halo of scientific research by a self-described expert. Now, that research, once it's created, is then fed and disseminated to mainstream media outlets. And the outfit says that doing so provides media the, this is using their phrase, larger global warming context as they cover natural disasters or even straight up weather in many instances. Now, here's where things get even more interesting. The group World Weather Attribution, it found itself as the beneficiary of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, of course, one of the richest individuals on the planet. A couple years ago, the Bezos Earth Fund announced a $10 million grant to World Weather Attribution and a couple of other organizations to, and this is the phrase that I found, scale effective communication on the links between climate change and extreme weather. Okay, the Bezos Earth Fund said the money would provide the World Weather Attribution Group an outlet to reach the most important audience segments via trusted messengers. And I suppose those trusted messengers are going to be mainstream media. But it gets even more interesting because one of those trusted messengers is the Washington Post. And guess who owns that newspaper? Bezos does. The Washington Post has cited World Weather Attribution research, using that term loosely perhaps, in over 70 stories over 3 years. And that stat came from the Washington Free Beacon, by the way. And of course, the Washington Post publishing the World Weather Attribution views, which are not peer-reviewed in most instances, to keep pounding the message and belief that climate change is causing any and all natural disasters and weather variances, it creates an interesting situation. And this is why you should do as I urged you at the start of this discussion, to know where your news is coming from. Bezos, his funding for the group, paired with the Washington Post's favorable coverage of the research coming out of that group, raises questions about the newspaper's objectivity. And it also raises questions about the Washington Post's independence from its billionaire owner, which, by the way, the Washington Post swears exists, that independence exists. But there is a clear conflict of interest at a minimum. Yet the Washington Post, its stories citing World Weather Attribution, do not acknowledge that Bezos also bankrolls World Weather Attribution. The motivation is entirely political. It's a quote from Ryan Mawe. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. And that is the former chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's what he said of the Climate Group. And I'm not sure, this is another quote from Mawe, I'm not sure what the scientific community's opinion on it is, but my guess is that it has gotten along this far because of its political weight and the media attention that it is given. Meaning, you don't want to be on the wrong side of this. That's from Ryan Mawe. Now, Mawe particularly criticized World Weather Attribution's methodology, which consists of determining the probability of a recent extreme weather event, let's say, comparing it with the probability of a similar event that occurred decades ago, and then attributing that difference to climate change. Now, that leads to flashy findings, but that doesn't mean that those flashy findings are going to be accurate ones, according to Mawe, who argued that World Weather Attribution values speed over accuracy, and as such, it produces incomplete research. So it's looking to get basically its views out there in time to make the headlines and get the clicks and the views and the likes and whatnot. World Weather Attribution founder, and I believe also the chief scientist there, meanwhile, has openly acknowledged that the group exists in part to create evidence that can then be admissible in climate litigation, including all kinds of high-stakes cases that are accusing entities like oil companies of climate change and then bearing financial responsibility for any subsequent weather event. So these studies basically are used to pressure policymakers, and they're also meant to spur companies like fossil fuel companies to basically change their business model and to adjust their behavior. Now, for its part, the Washington Post says that it is, and I'm using their words here, an independent news organization committed to covering the consequential issues of climate change, including the leaders, organizations, and forces involved. That's from the Washington Post, for the record. Yeah, know where your news comes from, constant listeners. There might be more going on behind the scenes than good old objective journalism. Let's make a connection from one area that media focuses on quite a bit these days, climate change, to another area that media is all over these days, and rightfully so in this case. That is what the Supreme Court has been up to. I've got some good news to report on what the highest court of the land is doing in an arena of individual rights. It deals with a case involving the death penalty. And some of you may know or recall from prior podcast episodes, I am not a fan of capital punishment. Because being wrong on a verdict, convicting the wrong person one time, that's going to result in the killing of an innocent person. I favor life in prison for such convictions in lieu of the death penalty, unless the accused admits to the killing or there is some sort of direct observable evidence documentation, such as a video that clearly identifies the killer. Now, the Supreme Court is dealing potentially a fatal blow to the death penalty, pun intended, with its review of the case of an Oklahoma death row inmate by the name of Richard Glossop. And as of this recording, I don't know yet what the specific ruling will be from the Supreme Court. They've not issued an opinion yet, but this is an interesting case where we know no matter what the specific ruling, the death penalty and capital punishment, they may be suffering some setbacks. So let me explain how. On one hand, if the court rules in favor of Glossop, that's the more obvious scenario in terms of what the outcome might be, it's going to acknowledge that a grave injustice has taken place to the point where it nearly resulted in the killing of an innocent man. And that's going to create an even greater concern about the finality of the death penalty and how it statistically is going to be certain to kill innocent people over time. But if the court decides against Glossop, it will still hurt the future prospects of the death penalty. Why? How? Well, Oklahoma, the state where Glossop is held, will have to move forward with his execution. Yet almost every powerful politician and policymaker, most of which, if not all of them, are Republican, by the way, in the state, they oppose executing him, which means the calls to end capital punishment in states like Oklahoma, it's only going to grow. And unfortunately, Glossop in this scenario becomes a casualty, literally. Now, Brett Farley is the executive director of Catholic Conference of Oklahoma, which opposes the death penalty. He summed up the analysis of this case as follows. No matter which side of the Glossop case the Supreme Court ultimately agrees with, state leaders will be forced to answer why Oklahoma has insisted on executing a man without considering new, potentially exculpatory evidence. It's simply indefensible. That's well said by Brett Farley. Now, a little bit of background on this case, if you're interested, and it is interesting. Glossop was convicted of murder in 1998, long time ago, and has been on Oklahoma's death row since. And he's there for the 1997 murder of the owner of an Oklahoma City motel where Glossop worked as a manager. The guilty verdict rested entirely on testimony from a meth addict and a violent criminal, someone with a violent criminal record background, who also worked at the motel as a maintenance man. And the accuser of Glossop received a lighter sentence as a reward for his testifying. There was no forensic evidence connecting Glossop to the murder. And the person who testified that Glossop killed the owner wrote a letter to his own defense lawyer confessing his regret over the case. He wrote that letter in 2007, a decade after the murder itself and almost a decade after the conviction. The state's top prosecutor filed a brief to the Supreme Court in which he noted that new evidence showed that the person who testified against Glossop lied on the stand and that prosecutors who were aware of that occurring did nothing to correct the record. That's from the state prosecutor, mind you. But execution for the murder still hangs over Glossop as we close out 2024. because in Oklahoma, the governor can commute a death sentence only if the state's pardon and parole board gives the okay, and the board has refused to do so. How about this quote from Oklahoma's Republican pro-death penalty attorney general? Okay, this is what this individual said on the Glossop situation. "I don't believe the justice is served by executing a man based on the testimony of a compromised witness." That's pretty amazing. A pro-death penalty Republican in Oklahoma state legislature said, "If Glossop is executed, I will fight the state to end the death penalty. And you'll see the state of Oklahoma go through some extreme changes on their views." Yeah, it has not, by the way, been an easy journey for Glossop. He's now in his 60s. He spent the past two decades in solitary confinement. He's been scheduled to die nine times, and has had three last meals. Unbelievable. Now, it might take the Supreme Court a while to issue its opinion, or it may have already done so by the time you're listening to this episode of The Far Middle. I'm hopeful. We'll see how it turns out. Glossop, for his part, he is upbeat. He said, "I know that day is coming soon where her, his wife, and I will be standing out there in the sun and enjoying and breathing the air." Let's close Far Middle 186 by making a connection from the alleged crime, and I want to emphasize alleged crime of Glossop, to an actual crime from way back that very few know of, but a crime that made something everyone knows of famous. Let me start this thought by asking you a quick question. What's the most famous portrait painting in the world? Now, you think a minute, most of you are going to answer the Mona Lisa by Da Vinci. It's the Louvre's most famous piece in Paris. Even the artistically challenged like me know that. But the Mona Lisa, which was painted in 1507, didn't become famous until around 1911, because that was when it was stolen out of the Louvre by three Italian handymen led by a gentleman by the name of Vincenzo Perugia. On a summer morning, with the museum still closed, the trio lifted the painting and its framing off the wall, covered the canvas with a blanket, they left the museum, and they jumped on a train out of Paris. Now, no one even noticed the painting was gone from the wall of the museum for over 24 hours. It was an artist who was painting the gallery where the Mona Lisa was supposed to be displayed that noticed, hey, it's not there anymore, it's gone. But once the theft was discovered, the Mona Lisa took on global celebrity because newspapers all over the world ran headlines about the missing masterpiece. Rewards were posted for its return. In France, there was a lot of anti-American feelings and paranoia that American business tycoons were buying up all the classic art and taking it away from Europe. So J.P. Morgan was suspected of commissioning the theft. Pablo Picasso was also considered a suspect, and he was actually questioned, which is crazy. World War I was brewing, and thus people thought the Kaiser coordinated the theft. And the Louvre shut down for a week. It reopened. When it reopened, there were mobs of people wanting to see the empty spot where the painting once hung. They basically entered the museum to see where a painting wasn't, which is odd. And thus the Mona Lisa became a global phenom. Now, ironically, the ringleader of the thieves, Perugia, he was a handyman working in the Louvre and was the person who installed the painting's protective glass. 28 months after the theft, he was caught when trying to return the painting for a reward. He said he was trying to return it to Italy, that he was a patriot, and that it was stolen by Napoleon. I admit that's a good defense, but theft is still theft. And by the way, he spent 8 months in prison for his crime. Now, when the Mona Lisa returned so that it could sit in the Louvre where it does today, when did that occur? On our episode 186 air date, December 11th, back in 1913. And that, constant listeners, is how the Mona Lisa became the most famous portrait painting in the world. We're going to convene again in a week. Until then, remember to always stay connected to that far middle.